Can you talk about your concerns about deaths being misreported by coronavirus because of either testing or standards for how they're characterized?
So I think in this country, we've taken a very liberal approach to mortality. And I think the reporting here has been pretty straightforward over the last 5 to 6 weeks. Prior to that, when there wasn't testing in January and February, that's a very different situation and unknown. There are other countries that if you had a pre-existing condition, and let's say the virus caused you to go to the ICU and then have a heart or kidney problem, some countries are recording that as a heart issue or a kidney issue and not a COVID-19 death. Right now, we're still recording it, and the great thing about having forms that come in and a form that has the ability to mark it as COVID-19 infection, the intent is right now that those, if someone dies with COVID-19, we are counting that as a COVID-19 death.
A Minnesota state senator says officials are asking doctors to fill out death certificates with diagnosis of COVID-19, whether the person died of it or not. Valley News Team's Callie Hubbard talked to the lawmaker today, who says fear may be coming into play.
Dr. Jensen says each state's reported death numbers are making a lot of people fearful, adding that getting the number right is critical, especially during a pandemic.
Illinois' virus-related death toll continues to climb. The director of public health took time today to explain how the department rules someone an actual COVID death. It can be a little confusing. She says anyone who has COVID when they pass away will be included in that category. Dr. Ngozi Ezike explained this does not mean the virus caused that death, but if someone does test positive for COVID before dying, that is classified a coronavirus fatality.
You were in hospice and had already been given, you know, a few weeks to live, and then you also were found to have COVID, that would be counted as a COVID death. It means that if you died of a clear alternate cause, but you had COVID at the same time, it's still listed as a COVID death. So everyone who's listed as a COVID death doesn't mean that that was the cause of the death, but they had COVID at the time of death.
As a physician, I received an email last week from the Department of Health coaching me on how to fill out death certificates. And I've never really received coaching from the Vital Statistics Agency in terms of how to do a death certificate. But basically, I felt like they were saying, you know, you don't have to have a confirmed laboratory test for COVID-19 in order to make the death certificate be COVID-19.
Sir, I don't mean to interrupt you, but that and what you just said, I think is critically important. Can you repeat what you just said, please?
My next guest is a doctor and state senator in Minnesota who is deeply troubled by the CDC's latest guidance for counting COVID deaths. Dr. Scott Jensen joins me now. Doctor, I want to read for our viewers what the CDC says in part about how to count COVID deaths relating to that last issue we just raised. In cases where a definite diagnosis of COVID cannot be made, but is suspected or likely, like the circumstances are compelling with a reasonable degree of certainty, it is acceptable to report COVID-19 on a death certificate as probable or presumed. So, doctor, what's the problem with that?
Well, in short, it's ridiculous. I spent some time earlier today just going through the CDC's manual on how to complete death certificates and the parts that were specifically written for physicians. And in that manual, it talks of precision and specificity, and that's what we were trained with. The determination of the cause of death is a big deal. It has impact on estate planning. It has impact on future generations. And the idea that we're going to allow people to massage and sort of game the numbers is a real issue, because we're going to undermine the trust. And right now, as we see politicians doing things that aren't necessarily motivated on fact and science, the public's going to, their trust in politicians is already wearing thin.
State of Texas DSHS has informed public health departments that they have adopted a revised definition for COVID-19 probable cases.
So for confirmed case, it stays the same. You still just need PCR. But now they've added a probable case definition. So that still gets counted towards the case count. It's different. It's not confirmed. It's probable, but it's still a case. So at the end of this definition, there are 15 different options on how you could be classified as a probable case. Based on this diagram and what they report, there's a total of 17 cases now. One is still only confirmed because that was that original index case who then had all these contacts underneath in orange. And all the rest of them became probable, but they are still considered a case.
It has the potential to be a very significant event for us here in Texas and here in Collin County, as the state now has elected to adopt this new probable definition. If you have a subjective fever and you have a headache and you live in Collin County, you now meet the qualifications to be a probable COVID patient. It is remarkable how low the standard is now. Mm-hmm. If you have one of the major symptoms, you have a cough or you have shortness of breath, and you live in Collin County, then you can satisfy the definition for a probable COVID case. But I'm very concerned that we absolutely could see the numbers jump very rapidly in a way that actually is not indicative of what we're seeing here in the community in the public health department. But I'm very concerned that we absolutely could see the numbers jump very rapidly in a way that actually is not indicative of what we're seeing here in the community in the public health department.
But they concede that it is a judgment call. Again, why is that not correct?
Well, let's just take influenza. If I have a patient died a month ago, had fever, cough, and died after 3 days, and maybe had been an elderly, fragile individual, and there happened to be an influenza epidemic around our community, I wouldn't put influenza on the death certificate, and I've never been encouraged to do so. I would put probably respiratory arrest would be the top line, and the underlying cause of disease would be pneumonia. And in the contributing factors, I might well put emphysema or congestive heart failure. But I would never put influenza down as the underlying cause of death. And yet that's what we're being asked to do here.
And then we found out that the mortality rates were not being honestly calculated in the United States in particular. Anybody dying of anything, it would end up being COVID. Then there was an undercover investigation, found out that every funeral home they were calling, the people weren't even getting any autopsy reports, or they were just saying COVID, COVID, COVID for everything.
I mean, let's just take someone getting hit by a bus and they collapse along and they go into the emergency room and they're there for 15, 20 minutes. Blood work comes back. COVID test comes back positive, and they die 20 minutes later because of their collapsed lung. We're going to put that down as COVID-19? That doesn't make any sense.
I think this question is probably for Minister Elliott, actually. I know you've taken questions before about how we include positive COVID-19 cases in deaths, but with regards to the one that we unfortunately just read about, the young girl, the word from Toronto Public Health is that she died of health complications unrelated to COVID-19, but did test positive. So I'm just curious if you want to reiterate why that is being categorized, if it's unrelated to the COVID-19 positive, why it's being listed anyway.
Well, first of all, any death as a result of COVID or where COVID is situated is a tragedy, as it certainly was in this case. I'd like to extend my condolences to the family of this young person. It's a terrible thing to lose a child. But in some cases, I'm not saying specifically with respect to this case, but in some cases there are situations where there are other pre-existing conditions that may actually be the cause of the loss rather than COVID. COVID is there but may not have been the cause of death. But again, it's going to be subject to an investigation by the local public health officers to follow up and to make sure that anyone who was in the presence of this person, this child, receives the proper follow-up and testing if it's necessary for them. But again, my condolences to the family.
My heart is sinking right now as you're telling me this. You're a doctor. Why in the world would they be sending you out information to fill out death certificates, whether the person's been diagnosed with COVID-19 or not, but then to say in the death certificate this person's death was caused by COVID-19. That does not sound right to me.
I went to the person in our office who does most of the death certificates over the last, 10, 20 years, and I said, does this sound right? I had her look at the documents that I printed off, and she said, well, we've always been told that you always put down just facts. You don't put down any probabilities. You don't put any presumptions down. It's just what you know. And so this is concerning, and it actually gets to your point, Chris. When we start talking about the data that goes into the modeling, we have to ask ourselves a question. Are we being forthright? Are we sharing with the public? Minnesota, North Dakota, we don't need to be having it sugar-coated. We want to know what's going into your modeling.
So when we get these startling record number of deaths in Italy, they can't get coffins fast enough. Well, hold on a second. We get this, for example, from offguardian.org talking about this Italian mortality phenomenon. They have a post, Italy, only 12% of COVID-19 deaths list COVID-19 as cause. Report shows up to 88% of Italy's alleged COVID-19 deaths could be misattributed. And they talk about the report, citing Professor Walter Ricciardi, in which he says, the way in which we code deaths in our country is very generous in the sense that all the people who die in hospitals with the coronavirus are deemed to be dying of the coronavirus. On reevaluation by the National Institute of Health, only 12% of death certificates have shown a direct causality from coronavirus, while 88% of patients who have died have at least one premorbidity, i.e. other type of disease. Many had two or three. As OffGuardian notes, this has been reported widely. It was even in the Telegraph, and yet no one seems to be engaging with it. The president of the Italian Civil Protection Service actually went out of his way to remind people on the nature of Italy's fatality figures in a morning briefing on March 20th. I want you to remember these people died with the coronavirus and not from the coronavirus. What does this actually mean? It means that the Italian death toll figures could have been artificially inflated by up to 88%. If true, this would mean the total number of Italians who have actually died of COVID-19 could be as low as 700, which would bring Italy, currently a statistical outlier in terms of COVID-19 fatalities, well in line with the rest of the world. It means thousands of deaths currently widely attributed to COVID-19 and being used to justify the introduction of measures equating to medical martial law may not have died of COVID-19 at all, but of their serious chronic comorbidity, cancer, heart disease, etc. This statistic is not a secret or in any way controversial. It was in the Telegraph, after all. But people seem to be ignoring it or reading around it or perhaps simply not understanding it. But this, of course, isn't just about Italy. This is about that death number that's being flashed in front of your face every hour on the hour on every mainstream broadcast you watch. The death toll has risen by X amount today. There's a few things that I want to point out. One, just the general point that I want to make here that I made in my recent article, The Things You Cannot Say About Coronavirus. Again, I hope you have read that article. I hope you have shared it with others because I think it makes some important points. But I do make the point specifically in that article that I do not trust a single one of the numbers being reported about this outbreak. And there are many ways to interpret that statement. It doesn't necessarily mean that everything's a hoax, but it certainly does mean that there's, even within mainstream land, even in the most mainstream circles, there are people trying to blow the whistle about some of the shenanigans that are going on here. And I make that point specifically in this article where I write, why listen to James Corbett, conspiracy theorist, or those silly Italian government health advisors on this matter? Well, I'm not alone in this suspicion of the official numbers. It turns out the Our World in Data research group that has been attempting to keep track of the coronavirus numbers has stopped using the World Health Organization's data because we found many errors in the data published by the WHO when we went through all the daily situation reports. Even within very mainstream circles, there are people trying to blow the whistle and say these numbers are not being reported in a way that will even be meaningful to you. Once again, it is not James Corbett saying that. It's Yahoo, or Bloomberg via Yahoo Finance, confirmed coronavirus cases is an almost meaningless metric.
Hello, everyone. It is the 22nd of June, 2020. My name is Anna Brees, and I'm about to do an interview with Paul Hickey. He is 39 years old. He lives in Northwest Manchester, and he sent me an email about a story that I felt that we should share with the people on this channel and with other individuals across the social media platforms about something that he got involved with in relation to the death of a contact of one of your friends. And we're only going to call this individual Farid. And it's a call that was recorded without the person knowing in the coroner's office.
Definitely. So like I say, we're just awaiting that result coming back, which will be, once that comes back, if it's deemed positive result, then what the mortuary staff will do is come back to ourselves just to let us know that, and they will record the death as being COVID-19.
See, now that is odd to me because it didn't seem like a COVID death apparently at the time.
I think they're swabbing everybody who goes into that hospital.
Yeah, I understand that, but you know, people die of lots of things. People have viruses in their bodies, all sorts of things going on. It doesn't necessarily mean that someone has died of COVID just because.
I fully understand. And if it comes back negative, the post-mortem would be carried out.
So if it comes back positive, they won't carry out a post-mortem, they'll just label it as a COVID death and then we can all move on?
Correct.
Right, okay. okay, yeah. Thanks for letting me know.
Unfortunately, Mr. Hickey, that's the way that things are being dealt with at the moment, and it's not quite right. No, it's not, because, you know, some people, as you say, they may be symptomatic of COVID, but it might not be COVID. You know, at the moment, I've got a streaming nose indicative of a cold, but it's not. It's hay fever.
Right.
So I can understand where families are coming from when they're like, well, how do we know it was definitely COVID? But it's because they are swabbed and they come back as COVID, as positive for the coronavirus. And that is the only thing that they check for when they do the swab is for the corona.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much for getting in touch with me late in the day.
No problems. And I'll give you a contact call tomorrow, hopefully advising that we've had the results through.
All right. Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks very much for calling, Paul. Take care.
Bye.
Dr. Fauci was asked about the COVID death count today. Here's what he said in part.
What do you say to those folks who are making the claim without really any evidence that these deaths are being padded, that the number of COVID-19 deaths are being padded?
You will always have conspiracy theories when you have very challenging public health crises. They are nothing but distractions.
Conspiracy theories, doctor? So you're engaging in conspiracy theories. What do you say to Dr. Fauci tonight?
Well, I would remind him that anytime healthcare intersects with dollars, it gets awkward. Right now, Medicare has determined that if you have a COVID-19 admission to the hospital, you'll get paid $13,000. If that COVID-19 patient goes on a ventilator, you get $39,000, three times as much. Nobody can tell me after 35 years in the world of medicine that sometimes those kinds of things impact on what we do. Some physicians really have a bent towards public health, and they will put down influenza or whatever because that's their preference. I try to stay very specific, very precise. If I know I've got pneumonia, that's what's going on the death certificate. I'm not going to add stuff just because it's convenient. I think that it's not a conspiracy theory at all.
You reject what he said.
Absolutely.
So let's start going through that list. Let's let people know about some of these conditions, how and when and by whom were they created.
Sure, James, I'd be happy to. So the first condition is the very broad definition of COVID and of an infection with a novel coronavirus. And this, as you said, does apply in many other places. I was just looking at the conditions in the UK from the Geriatric Society there. And you can have the sniffles and you're deemed to have COVID. And here it's a little more, smaller, more narrow definition. You can have sniffles and a cough and then you've got COVID. So these were set right from the beginning of the pandemic. At least in Ontario, they said that anybody if in a long-term care home specifically or in a congregate setting for seniors, one person could have one symptom and then the whole long-term care home would be deemed to be an outbreak, and anybody else who got any sort of symptom was deemed to have COVID. So that means that it's they've just opened up the door to an outbreak. Anybody who has any symptom is deemed to have COVID. So if they die, they're therefore also deemed to have COVID. And what we usually should see, though, is a narrowing of the definition. So you can really be sure these people had that condition.
Also, there was a reporter on the line because of our conversation. And, you know, you were on the Laura Ingraham show last night and you had alluded to maybe there were some financial purposes or financial reasons to inflate the COVID-19 deaths. She just said at the end of that conversation there that I played for our audience, there's no policy and no politics that would cause anyone to want to inflate those numbers. What say you?
I can't buy into that. I think we're going to have hospitals shut down and potentially never open their doors again. This is serious business. We might have the big metropolitan healthcare systems getting big chunks of money from the feds, but the bottom line is your outer ring hospitals and your hospitals out in Minnesota that aren't critical access, they're at risk. So I think that I would rather have people draw their own conclusions. Let me just say this. If I admit a patient to the hospital and they're on Medicare, and they have just routine pneumonia for a diagnosis, the hospital will get a lump sum payment called a DRG, and it'll be about $4,600. If I admit that same patient and I attach COVID-19 to the pneumonia diagnosis, then it goes from $4,600 to $13,000 for that admission, regardless of whether the patient's in a hospital for 3 days or 13 days. If during that hospitalization, I put the patient on a ventilator for a period of time, then the payment goes from $13,000 to $39,000. Now, that's a big payment. You're not going to see many outstate hospitals get access to those kind of dollars.
Why would they want to skew the number of deaths due to COVID-19?
Well, fear is a great way to control people. And I worry about that. I worry that sometimes we're so darn interested in just jazzing up the fear factor that, you know, sometimes people's ability to think for themselves is paralyzed if they're frightened enough. And that's not where I want people to be. I want people to say, we're going to get through this. I'm going to use my head. I'm going to go to different sources. I'm going to listen to different sources. And I'm going to think for myself, because that's what America's about.
And I think the real question here, not so much that it is being done or how it is being done, but really why is this being done? There is clearly an agenda towards this that, as I say, is not just happening in Ontario, but you've obviously documented that extremely well in this study. But as I say, it's happening in the UK, it's happening in North America generally. Why is this taking place?
What I posit in my article, James, is it's because it saves the government money. Assuming government is amoral, many of us would say a lot of them are immoral, but let's say they are amoral. They don't have particularly... ethics aren't that important to them, but because old people are expensive. I mean, that's the later stage of life when you're in a care home, for example, you take a lot of care, you're expensive, and you really don't contribute that much to the tax base. And some people I tell this to that saying, oh, they're doing it, you know, there is an economic motive. They can't believe it. But I've certainly, there's lots of, I think even the World Economic Forum, they've produced papers saying, you know, there are, you know, old people are expensive. They don't say, therefore, we should cull the elderly population. They're not going to be that bald, but they are certainly, governments are struggling to not have their deficits and their debts rise too high. So this is one way to reduce costs.
I think that's an obviously identifiable concern here, and certainly that does line up. But I think there are other things at play, and you did mention in your introduction that one of the things that you found in your time as a reporter on these issues was that there was always some sort of big pharma involvement, and what's the angle or the take of this particular doctor, you know, how are they going to lie to me? And in fact, when digging up some material for our conversation, I noticed that you had testified to the Toronto Board of Health last year about addressing vaccine hesitancy. Which, of course, is framed, that entire debate is framed as anyone who has any questions about any vaccine safety or efficacy is a loony and should not be taken seriously, and how do we address this? Whereas you yourself and other other people who were addressing the Toronto Board of Health made very important points, and I will put the link in so people can go and watch your testimony. I think it's important, but important points about how this is obviously there is a bottom line for Big Pharma in helping to push this agenda. Do we see a similar type of push with regards to Big Pharma connections to government institutions in this latest attempt to jack up the COVID-19 crisis?
Oh, so you're saying, okay, I understand. I hadn't even thought of that. So you're saying this will help to increase the death toll by all these death, a lot of older people in seniors' homes dying. And so it'll make people more scared, so they're going to line up more readily for the vaccine. Ah, that makes a lot of sense. And they've been, because they were pushing this, saying when we testified at the Toronto Board of Health, they were saying there shouldn't be any information about any problems with any vaccines out there. And we were saying, that's a big problem. There are problems with vaccines. And they were saying, no. So that's quieting even more any voices of raising any objection to vaccines. So that even more paves the way for now. What's happening now, where they're going to be rushing this vaccine through, and people don't really, there won't be much.
If there is no sense of crisis, there's no reason for the public to be lining up to take their shots, and no reason for governments to be spending billions upon billions upon billions of dollars to make sure every person is vaccinated. So I think the crisis has to be magnified as much as possible. From the start, the World Health Organization has directed the global response to the current pandemic. From its initial monitoring of the outbreak in Wuhan and its declaration in January that there was no evidence of human-to-human transmission, to its live media briefings and its technical guidance on country-level planning and other matters, the WHO has been the body setting the guidelines and recommendations shaping the global response to this outbreak. But even the World Health Organization itself is largely reliant on funds from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The WHO's most recent donor report shows that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is the organization's second largest donor behind the United States government. The Gates Foundation single-handedly contributes more to the World Health Body than Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Russia, and the UK combined. The work of two research groups was crucial in shaping the decisions of the UK and US governments to implement wide-ranging lockdowns, and, in turn, governments around the world. The first group, the Imperial College COVID-19 Research Team, issued a report on March 16th that predicted up to 500,000 deaths in the UK and 2.2 million deaths in the US unless strict government measures were put in place. The second group, the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in Bill Gates' home state of Washington, helped provide data that corroborated the White House's initial estimates of the virus effects, estimates that have been repeatedly downgraded as the situation has progressed. Unsurprisingly, the Gates Foundation has injected substantial sums of money into both groups. This year alone, the Gates Foundation has already given $79 million to Imperial College. And in 2017, the foundation announced a $279 million investment into the IHME to expand its work collecting health data and creating models. Anthony Fauci, meanwhile, has become the face of the U.S. government's coronavirus response, echoing Bill Gates' assertion that the country will not get back to normal until a good vaccine can be found to ensure the public's safety.
If you want to get to pre-coronavirus, you know, that might not ever happen in the sense of the fact that the threat is there. But I believe with the therapies that will be coming online and with the fact that I feel confident that over a period of time we will get a good vaccine, that we will never have to get back to where we are right back now.
Given Gates' pledge to make this a decade of vaccines, it should come as no surprise that, since the dawn of this coronavirus crisis, he has been adamant that the world will not go back to normal until a vaccine has been developed.
But we're going to have this intermediate period of opening up, and it won't be normal until we get an amazing vaccine to the entire world. The vaccine is critical because until you have that, things aren't really going to be normal. They can open up to some degree, but the risk of a rebound will be there until we have very broad vaccination. Well, they won't be back to normal until we either have that phenomenal vaccine or a therapeutic that's like over 95% effective. And so we have to assume that's going to be almost 18 months from now. And then the final solution which is a year to 2 years off, is the vaccine. So we've got to go full speed ahead on all three fronts.
Just to head off the conspiracy theorists, maybe we shouldn't call the vaccine the final solution. Maybe just the best solution. Okay.
More interestingly, since Gates began delivering this same talking point in every one of his many media appearances of late, it has been picked up and repeated by heads of state, health officials, doctors, and media talking heads, right down to the scientifically arbitrary but very specific 18-month time frame.
Realistically, COVID-19 will be here for the next 18 months or more. We will not be able to return to normalcy until we find a vaccine or effective medications.
The hard fact is, until we find a vaccine, going back to normal means putting lives at risk.
This will be the new normal until a vaccine is developed.
The only thing that will really allow life as we once knew it to resume is a vaccine.
Even if you died of a clear alternate cause, but you had COVID at the same time, it's still listed as a COVID death.
If someone dies with COVID-19, we are counting that as a COVID-19 death.
You can have the sniffles and you're deemed to have COVID.
If you have a subjective fever and you have a headache, you now meet the qualifications to be a probable COVID patient.
There are situations where there are other pre-existing conditions that may actually be the cause of the loss rather than COVID. COVID is there, but may not have been the cause of death.
Unfortunately, Mr. Hickey, that's the way that things are being dealt with at the moment, and it's not quite right.